You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, it's our weekly state news roundup with Robert Menser. Today, we'll look at the governor's comments about the new Republican health care bill, what happened in the state legislature this week, and how well Wisconsin cheeses did in a big national competition.
First, the Naval Criminal Investigative Service is investigating hundreds of Marines who solicited and shared nude and compromising photos of female service members. Initial reports found that hundreds, potentially thousands of photos were being shared in the Facebook group Marines United, which had about 30,000 members.
But new reports are saying that the problem goes far beyond the Marines and a single Facebook group. Business Insider and the BBC reported that other branches of the military also posted photos of their female colleagues to another message board.
Some of the photos that were shared are believed to have been taken secretly without consent. Others are believed to have been taken consensually but posted without permission.
Kate Hendricks-Thomas is a former Marine Corps officer who wrote about the sexual harassment that she faced in the service. You can see her article on the Central Time Facebook page. Now she's an assistant professor at Charleston Southern University and board member for the Service Women's Action Network, and she joins us now. Kate, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you so much for having me.
Well, Kate, what was your first reaction when you heard about these reports?
Well, candidly, I was shocked at the scale. I was shocked at the size of the initially reported Facebook group. 30,000 Marine veterans and active duty Marines is a lot of Marines. I was not surprised that harassment was going on. I was surprised at the reach.
I'm a little surprised that you were surprised, given that the harassment you faced when you were in the Marine Corps, there was some pretty difficult situations that you were faced with there. So what surprised you about the scope of this?
Specifically, it sounds like, and again, I wasn't a member of the site, but it sounds like there were a lot of participants who, whether they engaged in the violent commentary or the non-consensual sharing of these naked photographs, some of them clothed photographs, or even worse, the cyber-stalking or the actual stalking that was going on, even if folks weren't participating in that, they were passively noticing that it was happening and failing to report it. That, to me, speaks to a larger culture that I was actually a part of. I faced a fair amount of harassment in the military, and I did not always make a formal complaint about it, because it starts to become normative, and you want to be an issue-free team player, not draw unwanted attention.
You came from a military family, a Marine family. You went on, as you said, to serve in the Marine Corps yourself. And I wonder if you'd be willing to share some of what happened to you when you were in your 20s and you faced, for instance, what looked very likely to be an attempted rape and also other sexual harassment. What happened?
Well, there were plenty of small conversations and that aren't even worth mentioning. But I do remember getting to my first unit, and we ran our physical fitness test. And afterwards, I'm a young, brand-new second lieutenant. I'm proud to be leading Marines. And my platoon sergeant pulled me aside and said, "Hey, ma'am, the Marines were commenting on your physical attributes, specifically my derriere. We wear these athletic running shorts. And there are some other shorts that are big and bulky and old, and no athlete ever wears them and runs in them." And the platoon sergeant said, "Maybe you should buy some of those shorts so that the Marines won't notice your butt." Instead of saying, "Just to let you know, this happened, I took corrective action." So that was kind of an introduction to what was to come. It got significant when I was in Iraq. I did have, I was down in southern Iraq, and I did have some, these were not American soldiers that tried to break into the area I was sleeping. And actually, my own Marines came out, and the reason that they drunkenly ran off was, me answering the door with my weapon and my own Marines flooding out and angrily swearing at them. So I didn't report that. We left to go back to our own forward operating base the next day, and I truly didn't think much of it. I was kind of numb. While I was on, while I was in Al Anbar, I often, if I was going to be on the base, I carried black spray paint in my cargo pocket, and a lot of the male Marines that I was real close friends with did too. And the reason for that was that we kept finding these really descriptive cartoon drawings all over the inside of port-a-johns, which that's not a place that people would normally hang out and do artwork, you have to understand. So people were taking, Marines were taking black Sharpies with them to draw naked photographs of Lieutenant Hendricks in various sexual positioning. And then I could see commentary off to the side, and it was different handwriting. Lots of people had contributed to it. And it would get increasingly, you know, descriptive and offensive. So hence the spray paint.
And you never
report that.
Well, you never reported this, as you said, and it sounds like that's something you're thinking twice about now. And I wonder, given your stories and then where we are today with this current story about the photos, the new photos, the stalking behavior, is there something in particular about the Marine Corps, maybe more broadly in the U.S. military, that makes it a hostile place for women, do you think?
Well, we are a numerical minority, so you're kind of dealing with that. But we also sex segregate our entry-level training. We don't have specialty-specific performance standards, so there's some very institutional separations between men and women. And I'll tell you right now, I'll give you a small example. When we run an obstacle course at the basic school, there are all these different physical tests that we have to do. We would all run it together as a company, but the women would have a special lane with a ramp. I mean, and the idea was, well, you know, the women have less upper body strength. They can use this ramp to do the obstacle course. And so a lot of us would never use the ramp because it was such a visual statement of othering. And that's kind of an example. So you already have not very many of you. And then you have male Marines looking at you kind of every time you check into a new unit, every time you do something, they're looking at you and wondering, can you actually hack it here? Are you really a Marine or are you here because of the ramps? And women Marines, in my experience, don't want lower standards. They don't want to be othered and segregated out. They want to be part of the team, part of the fight.
And you've said that's part of the response you'd like to see from the Marines. Another response you're looking for is for a response from higher-ups in the military to make it public and to make it a firm response. Tell us more about what that means, what you're looking for.
Well, maybe I am a Pollyanna optimist, and I know that I love the institution, but when I read the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps statement and I heard the Commandant of the Marine Corps statement, and they said, pick a side. You're either part of the problem, part of the solution. These keyboard warriors are not Marines, and we are coming for you. I thought those words are strong. Now we need to see that happen. Because here's the issue. The only time I ever reported an incident of sexual harassment, it was not handled well by my command, and I've been hearing all week from military women who were either encouraged by commands to not make a formal report because it's a black eye for any unit. You know, it's embarrassing. It's, you know, obviously there's an order and discipline issue. And then I've heard from a lot of military women who dealt with reprisal, command-accepted reprisal. So my concern is that we follow up strong words with administrative action, and it can't just be what we did in 2014 when we said, well, we looked at social media sites, we found 12 Marines who were kind of in violation of our policy, and we handed that down to the command. I don't know what happened to those Marines. Nobody knows. It could have been something as simple as a letter of caution, a page 11 or a... Nobody knows. So we need to see a very public expulsion. If you were enlisted and you posted these photos or were stalking people, you're gone. If you were an officer and you were involved in any way, you saw it and failed to report, you did anything involved, you're gone. Now, I would say there is space for censure with enlisted Marines who, you know, were involved on some peripheral level. But we need to know, women Marines need to know that this is happening. And there's a lot of, you know, Senator Gillibrand's Military Justice Improvement Act was out there for a reason. There's a lot of concern that if you just send this off to the command without real follow-up, without the spotlight that, quite frankly, media outlets like your own are providing, there's potential for it to be, I won't say covered up, because not covered up, but just not taken seriously enough. It sounds to me like the Commandant and the Sergeant Major of the Marine Corps are taking this incredibly seriously, and I really have faith that the Marine Corps has the capability to adjudicate this.
We're talking right now with Kate Hendricks-Thomas. She's a former Marine Corps officer and works with the Service Women's Action Network. She wrote about dealing with sexual harassment when she was a Marine after news broke recently about U.S. service members sharing nude photos of their female colleagues.
We want to hear from you, especially if you have been in the armed services. Call in at 800-642-1234. Were you surprised to hear the reports, this widespread online sexual harassment and this photo sharing? How do you want to see the military respond to this scandal? Do you think enough has or is being done about this? What was your experience? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We'll continue our conversation in just a little bit here on Central Time.
This is Central Time. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. We're continuing the conversation now about the nude photo sharing scandal within the U.S. military. And we're talking with Kate Hendricks-Thomas. She's a former Marine Corps officer who wrote recently about dealing with sexual harassment while she was in the service.
You can join in at 800-642-1234. How do you think this recent photo scandal, hundreds, maybe thousands of photos shared without consent of female service members, Marines at first, other branches too. How do you want to see the Pentagon, the Department of Defense, handle this? If you've served in the armed forces, tell us about your experience. How do you think the military handles issues like sexual harassment? Call in now at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234 or post on the Central Time Facebook page.
And we take our first caller now. We have Jake joining us from South Milwaukee. Hi, Jake.
Thank you for taking my call.
Sure. What did you want to share?
I just wanted to share my experience of my battalion actually receiving our first female member. I was a member of a combat engineer battalion. It was a combat MOS. And in order to comply with the order to start rolling women into our ranks, we received one from the engineering school. I had trained with females before, but it was understood that they would not be going to where I was going, which would have been a potential frontline unit. So when she got there, she checked in as was necessary, was posted to segregated quarters, given a 24-hour guard outside her door, and in 3 days she was gone. I don't know officially what happened, but the word was that our command made an official complaint. My guess was fearing what her presence could lead to.
Jake, thank you. That's an interesting and maybe telling story about what it can be like, especially as you were saying, Kate, in the Marines, where there are fewer women than there are, say, in the Army. What do you think when you hear Jake's story?
Well, it sounds like the command was not comfortable having this Marine, but my perspective initially just immediately goes to that woman Marine. She trained to become a combat engineer. She gets assigned to a unit. All she wants to do is contribute and participate, but the command kind of set her up as a pariah immediately. So her experience of unit cohesion was never even possible from the day she checked in.
Jake, thank you so much for that. And let's take another call here from Dan in Menominee. Dan, hi.
Hi there. I just had a question for your guest. So this is clearly a huge problem and a bigger one than I realized. If she was given unlimited resources and authority to try to fix this, what would that solution look like?
And Kate, what do you say?
I think that's a wonderful question, but we want to be careful. You know, I left the Marine Corps after 5 years. I did a couple more as a reservist. I'm an O3. I'm a captain, and I'm a public health researcher now. I want to be careful to stay in my lane and not say that I should be recommending all policy changes and curriculum changes. I want to be careful not to step outside the scope of my experience and capabilities. I would stand by making institutional changes like changing entry-level training so that it's not sex-segregated, making one performance standard so that female Marines have a chance to belong if they can meet the bar. Women Marines have no desire for the bar to be lowered. We are joining the Marine Corps because it is an organization that is mission-focused, and the mission is a lethal mission. Women Marines have no desire to change any of that, but I will say that we need leadership with more experience than my humble capabilities to answer that question.
And Kate, what do you say now to women who might be listening now, who are dealing themselves with sexual harassment as you did in the military, in the Marines, in other sectors? What advice do you have for them?
Well, the first piece of advice I would have is take care of yourself first. There is no compulsion for you to tell your story. There is no mandate that you engage. If you feel comfortable doing so, reaching out and speaking to your command about what's going on, reaching out to other service women and speaking about your experience, I think you're going to be surprised at what you find. You're going to hear a whole lot of me too. And that was my experience. The first time I ever admitted, hey, there are some things going on, I don't think it's okay, I just heard this resounding chorus of, oh yes, that resonates with me. And that normalized things. And I realized this is a systemic problem, not a Kate Hendricks Thomas problem. And that can be really liberating. But take care of yourself first, and don't feel like you have to start sharing stories that you may or may not be ready to share.
Kate, thank you so much for joining us.
Thank you for having me, and thank you for the spotlight on this important issue.
That was former Marine Corps officer Kate Hendricks Thomas. She's now an assistant professor at Charleston Southern University and a board member for the Service Women's Action Network. She wrote about dealing with sexual harassment as a Marine following reports of military servicemen sharing nude and compromising photos of their female colleagues.
Now, our next installment in our year-long series called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. Wisconsin author and farm historian Jerry Apps says he's concerned about water. As Glenn Moberg reports, Apps says we need to change the way we look at something most of us take for granted.
We're going to have a fire here.
Jerry Apps lights the old wood stove in a farmhouse not far from the one he grew up in back in the 1930s near the small village of Wild Rose.
My dad would say, in no uncertain terms, never curse the rain.
Water was precious in a home with no indoor plumbing. It had to be hauled by hand every Saturday to that wood stove for the once-a-week family bath.
My brothers were bathed. Then it was my turn. Same water. Then my mother and finally my dad. We all bathed in the same water.
Water that was dependent on the farm's windmill.
Once the wind stopped blowing and the windmill quit turning, of course there was no water.
It's one of Jerry Apps' most vivid childhood memories.
It was a hot, dreary, dry night, and there was just that mournful, mournful cry of cattle wanting water, needing water, and not getting any water.
A few miles from the old farmstead was the Wild Rose Grist Mill, a building that is still standing.
This is the Pine River, by the way.
The water from the river ground the feed for the cattle. It also generated electricity for those fortunate enough to live in town.
The people in the village of Wild Rose had electricity, and the farm people just a few miles out of town did not. That created a tremendous rift.
An urban-rural rift that still exists in many places today, partly created by water.
As kids, I was ashamed to have my friends in town to come out to the farm because we had no indoor plumbing. They had all these things that we did not.
At the Wild Rose Community Library, there's an overflow crowd as Jerry Apps reads from his latest book, Never Curse the Rain.
You have running water out there yet at that farm?
My dad's response was, you bet we do. You grab up a pail and you run with it.
It strikes a chord with Janet Case, who grew up near Colby on a farm without electricity.
So I bathed in wash tubs, all like Jerry's stories.
The underlying message isn't lost on her.
I have a dear friend in Tucson. She speaks of the water level out there going down, down each year. We can't live without water.
We took baths in the barn.
The same thing with me in Texas.
Fred Johannes and Oscar Cardenas grew up together on nearby farms without running water. Cardenas was born into a migrant worker family. They, too, believe clean water will soon be a big issue.
We have an environmental problem. One group makes money off of it, and the rest of us are suffering.
Someday, maybe I won't see it. Someday, water is going to be very expensive.
Back at the farmhouse, Jerry Apps marvels at something most of us take for granted.
I can turn on a faucet and, oh my gosh, look at that. There's water.
He has seen how high-capacity wells have changed the landscape here in central Wisconsin.
There are entire lakes that have dried up, disappeared. People who own cottages on those lakes, now they sit looking at a pasture.
And he has seen how climate change is affecting Alaska, where he has conducted workshops.
One of the glaciers that I visited, it had receded like 3 miles. Just go there and look at it.
Jerry App says we now need the same reverence for water that his father had in the 1930s and that America's original inhabitants had before that.
Not only should we be concerned about our water in the year or two ahead, but as a Native American, say we must consider 7 generations ahead.
Future generations that he thinks could learn from the example of his past. Glenn Moberg, Wisconsin Public Radio News.
This story is part of a year-long reporting project at WPR called State of Change, Water, Food, and the Future of Wisconsin. You can find stories on Morning Edition, All Things Considered, the Ideas Network, and online at WPR.org/change.
Coming up, we'll look at some of the biggest Wisconsin stories from the past week with news editor Rob Menser. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. You're listening to Central Time on the Ideas Network.
You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up, arts projects across the state enjoy support from the National Endowment for the Arts, but recent reports say that the agency may be facing elimination in the next federal budget. We talk about what that would mean for Wisconsin.
First, it's time for our weekly review of state news. On Wednesday, Governor Walker held a press conference and would not say whether he supports the new health care bill to replace Obamacare, championed by House Speaker Paul Ryan. Here's what the governor said at that press conference.
It's a work in progress. I think there's a number of issues that have to be addressed, and we're going to work with both the House and Senate leadership on it.
Rob Menser joins us now for the details on this and other top news stories from the past week. He's a storytelling editor for the USA Today Network Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he joins us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news. Rob, welcome back to Central Time.
Hello, thank you.
Well, what did Governor Walker have to say on Wednesday about the new Republican health care bill?
Yeah, so I think you can sort of hear it there, the caution. You can add Governor Scott Walker to the list of people who maybe are not so fired up about the Obamacare replacement bill. Talking immediately about it as a work in progress, and he said he expects plenty of changes in the bill at that news conference in Whitefish Bay. The American Health Care Act was the big story this week out of Washington, the unveiling of the first time the Republican Party has really presented a concrete alternative to the Affordable Care Act. And, the immediate part of that story that follows is what is the reaction to the bill, and the bill has already come under fierce attack from conservatives who call it Obamacare light, as well as from moderate Republicans and from all Democrats for cutting health care subsidies, for limiting Medicaid funding, and for that it cuts taxes to the wealthy. So Walker's views on this are interesting for a couple of reasons. He is the chairman of the Republican Governors Association, so he in some sense can be seen as speaking for other governors as well. And also he's a good friends with Paul Ryan, whose bill this is, and has been a strong supporter of Paul Ryan's vision for the Republican Party in general. So it is a work in progress, and indeed the bill does have quite a long road to go before it will potentially become law, and presumably there will be a lot of changes. So there's nothing really inaccurate about it. It's just that, you know, in politics we like to sort of read tea leaves and understand by someone's tone how much political capital they really intend to spend on this bill. And so that's, I think, what people were looking for in out of Walker's comments.
Right. Does it sort of indicate to you, is it a marker that this bill is more contentious than maybe GOP legislators would like it to be if, a stalwart like Governor Walker, who has that close relationship with Paul Ryan, is at least not at this point throwing his full support behind it?
That's exactly it. I mean, Walker doesn't have a vote. He's not in Congress. But for a giant bill that makes a lot of radical changes and is, we can just say it's very likely to end up kicking off millions of people who currently have health insurance, for a bill like that to be passed, you would expect to see sort of an all hands on deck kind of effort, right? You would think that that Republicans would need people like Governor Walker to be going on television and whatever, speaking out about how great it is. Now it's early, right? It's just this bill is only a few days old, so we'll see how it shapes up. But I think that's exactly right. He was conspicuously being cautious and not sort of throwing that political support behind it.
What do you think would need to happen for Governor Walker and some of the other GOP governors who have reservations about the bill, especially regarding Medicaid? What do you think would need to happen for them to get on board?
Well, the Medicaid question is really interesting. It's one of the key issues here, especially as, and the fact is that different governors, even different Republican governors, have very different interests in this. So the American Healthcare Act bill, what it would do is, it doesn't cut the Medicaid expansion that was part of Obamacare until 2020. In 2020, it freezes Medicaid enrollment. Now, for people who rely on Medicaid, that is going to be bad, and that is a reason to be afraid. But for governors who did expand Medicaid coverage under the Affordable Care Act, that seems like it's better than it could have been. It's definitely better. It's less of a sharp break than what a lot of Republicans have been calling for the last 7 years. Now, Walker is different. Walker did not expand Medicaid. Wisconsin did not expand Medicaid. There is a provision in this bill that would grant some extra funds to Medicaid providers in states that didn't expand Medicaid. So that is something that Walker wanted. Obviously, that is something that would benefit Wisconsin. On the other hand, it just shows the different incentives that different governors, even within the Republican Party, have on this bill.
We're talking with Rob Menser right now, storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau, getting caught up on the state's news this week. And Rob, there was this big spotlight shining on the Republican health care plan. A lot of stuff, though, happened in the state legislature here in Wisconsin. Tell us about some of what had some motion this week.
Yeah, the Wisconsin legislature is doing things again. They're back. The state assembly passed a bill that would legalize the possession of CBD oil. This is used to treat seizures, and it's a bill that has been introduced before and didn't become law because the oil, CBD oil, is made from marijuana. It does not itself contain the chemical that actually gets you high, but nevertheless, there was opposition for that in previous sessions. Is the idea that it was kind of a first step toward legalization of marijuana. So that opposition cracked. The bill has already passed the state Senate. Governor Scott Walker has already said that he supports it, and now the Assembly has passed it. So that is on its way to becoming the law. Likewise, the Assembly passed a bill called Right to Try, which would give terminally ill patients access to experimental drugs that have not yet been approved by the Food and Drug Administration. The idea there is that FDA approval can take a long time, and not everyone can get into the clinical trials of these drugs. So it would open up at least some potential treatments to people who need them. So that's a lot going on.
And also possible, so looking at least more possible than it did a week ago, that the state treasurer's office would be eliminated. This would need to be a constitutional amendment, but where does that stand?
Yeah, the Senate voted to eliminate the office of the state treasurer. This is something that's been in the works for a long time. Legislators have already taken away all the duties of the office, so it doesn't really do anything. So they've made their vote to eliminate that office, which is a constitutional office. So that's a little ways off. The argument against is maybe instead we should restore the duties and give the state treasurer something to do again. But for now, yeah, it looks like it's headed toward extinction.
And also mandatory reporting of child abuse. This seems to be related to Lincoln Hills youth school and what the responsibilities would be for the guards there.
Right. This is another bill that passed in the Senate, requiring guards at Lincoln Hills to require them to report suspected child abuse. This is mandatory reporting is already required of teachers and daycare workers, a number of other professionals in the state. By law, they have to say something if they see evidence of abuse. And this is a bill that would extend that to prison guards. It's the legislature has stated that it is directly aimed at as a response to some of the reports of abuse at Lincoln Hills.
And Rob, finally in the legislature, three Democratic lawmakers introduced a bill that would legalize assisted suicide for the terminally ill in Wisconsin. Similar bill, though, failed in the last session. Is there any hope for this bill?
No hope whatsoever. No, I mean that's my reading. Who knows? I've been wrong many, many times. But this is a Democratic bill. It's modeled after a similar law in Oregon. But there's a lot of opposition. Pro-Life Wisconsin, the Catholic Church. I mean, the assisted suicide is not. I would say it is nigh impossible to see a Republican legislature and governor putting their weight behind that bill.
And finally, Rob, as we wrap up, a subject dear to my heart, Wisconsin cheese. There was a championship cheese contest in Green Bay this year in, I guess it was the Lambeau Field Atrium. And Wisconsin came out, surprise, on top with a lot of the cheeses anyway. Tell us about that.
Veronica, there may be many reasons why Wisconsin might feel status anxiety compared to other states. You know, we're not the biggest state, we're not the most populous, we're not the richest state, but by God, we make the very best cheese in the entire U.S. of A. So yeah, the U.S. Championship Cheese Contest, Wisconsin cleaned up 58 Best of Class awards, a total of 173 medals in 84 categories. As well as the very best cheese in America,
which was
the Sartori Reserve Black Pepper Bella Vitano out of Antigo. Which, can I say, I've eaten this cheese. This is delicious cheese.
I've had other Sartoris; they were delicious. So I'm expecting the same of this.
Yeah, they make a nice espresso cheese. I'm telling you, this the judges know what they're talking about on this.
Good stuff. Well, Rob, thanks a lot for joining us.
All right. Thank you.
That was Robert Menzer, storytelling editor for USA Today Network, Wisconsin, based in Wausau. And he's with us every Friday to look back at the week's biggest news.
You're listening to Central Time. I'm Rob Farah.
And I'm Veronica Rickert. Coming up tonight after 7, it's Ken Rudin's Political Junkie.
First, wherever you are in Wisconsin, you can likely find some art to enjoy. It might be murals in downtown Milwaukee or live theater in Chippewa Falls. Many of the state's art projects and facilities receive significant federal support from the National Endowment for the Arts.
However, recent reports from Washington say that President Trump's upcoming budget will propose eliminating the NEA, which is operating on a budget of about $149 million this year. Also facing possible elimination is its sibling organization, the National Endowment for the Humanities.
Liz DiNovella joins us now. She's a cultural critic and digital reporter based in Madison. She's co-author of a recent article for Tone Madison looking into the flow of federal money to art projects here in the state. Liz, welcome to Central Time.
It's great to be here.
Well, how much support does Wisconsin generally get from the National Endowment for the Arts and throw in the Endowment for the Humanities while you're at it?
Well, from 2010 to 2016, the National Endowment for the Arts and the National Endowment for the Humanities gave a combined $31 million to Wisconsin.
And how does that get allocated through the state?
Most of it gets allocated through, for the arts, something called the Wisconsin Arts Board. And for the humanities, it's the Wisconsin Center for Humanities. And so they act as the institution that sort of re-grants things.
So it's kind of a pass-through from the
yes.
federal government through the state board. Can you give a sense of what kind of things happen with that money in Wisconsin? What do we see from that?
Well, there's all sorts of different programs that you see, and you will see that large parts of the budget actually go to the larger cities, such as Milwaukee and here in Madison. You see things going to Arts Madison, to the Festival Choir, to the Children's Theater of Madison. And then you also see it if you look into different places in different counties. If you look in Chippewa, the Chippewa Valley Cultural Association got some money from them. The Kickapoo Cultural Exchange got a small amount of money from them out in Crawford County. The Portage Center for the Arts got a couple thousand dollars, and that's in Columbia County. So a lot of it is actually spread out throughout the state.
And I learned from the piece you co-wrote that Wisconsin, a Wisconsinite, played a role in making sure that federal arts funding didn't just go to the big cities.
Exactly, and that was... I have the example of it right here. It was Robert Gard.
Mm-hmm.
I knew I was going to do that. UW professor Robert Gard helped change the idea from all of the monies going to cities like New York, and he wrote a pamphlet called The Arts in the Small Community, a national plan. And this is in the 60s, and he really wanted to continue the idea of the Wisconsin idea of reaching out between the university and other parts of the state and to share information and knowledge. And so Wisconsin has been one of the leaders when it comes to supporting arts projects in rural areas. However, nationally right now, we're ranked at the bottom when it comes to how much money we spend on arts per person.
And that's at the state level.
That's at the state level. That's at the state level.
And this effort wasn't just bringing money to smaller towns and rural communities. This was also telling them how to use it, how to harness, I guess, the power of the arts and humanities in economic development. Is that right?
Yes, and even a recent study in 2005 showed that 15,000 jobs are created through the arts in Wisconsin, and that you can even break that down by some counties. I think it's a combination of things to support arts, and the public funding of arts is important because it allows organizations to get more funding from other people, organizations, entities, and so. The seed money is one way of looking at it. The amount that the state gives out to these smaller projects has a bigger impact than, say, the $2,000 grant specifically.
So they can kind of leverage that federal and or state money to get, I guess, private donations and other fundraising.
Exactly.
Grants, I imagine, too.
Exactly, exactly. Matching grants, that's what happened with the Madison Central Library. The Bubbler Program, which is the arts program, started with a $25,000 grant. a federal grant, and then it was matched by a local one. They no longer use that grant, but again, it was important seed money to get that project off the ground.
Talking to Liz DiNovella about arts and humanities funding, possible cuts coming at the federal level to the National Endowments for the Arts and for the Humanities, looking at what that would mean here in Wisconsin. Liz, over time, what's been the trend in federal and state art funding?
Well, over time, I mean, you can go back and look when the arts program started in 1965. And again, you have Wisconsin playing this important role in supporting arts in rural areas. And now the first big change came in the 90s. That's when the NEA and the NEH were really cut by Newt Gingrich and the Republicans, who were the majority in office at the time. There, you know, Ronald Reagan talked about cutting the NEA, but he actually did not cut it. And at the end of his term, they were actually at historic highs, the budgets for the NEA and NEH. And so you had in the 90s, you had some deep cuts. And then after the Great Recession, recently, you have this huge decrease in funding. So overall, national funding for the arts through the NEA and NEH is less than 1% of the total budget. And what we will see, though, with these cuts is that there's really not much more to cut, because these budgets have shrank enormously especially over the last 10 years with the recession.
And now, looking back over the past decade, sometimes when there was a debate over federal arts funding, there was some kind of a controversial art piece that had some element of federal funding. That's not really, those examples aren't representative, it sounds like, of what most of what the NEA and NEH are actually doing.
No, and that was, really Jesse Helms going, for Robert Mapplethorpe in 1989. And I feel like those issues sort of become a distraction to what happens to, like, in a state here in Wisconsin. Wisconsin gives 14 cents per capita for the arts, and the state of Minnesota does $5.50, just to show, like, the disparate amounts. And so what I think what could happen is that it isn't about controversial works that are going to get affected. I think what you are going to see are just smaller, more interesting things not happen, because smaller groups will not get seed money, and that lack of investment will make it even more hard for them, more difficult for them to get more support, funding, pledges from outside sources, including charitable grants or individuals.
So what do we lose as a state, as a culture in Wisconsin, if some of those smaller projects fall by the wayside without that federal funding?
We're seeing it now, in the sense that the arts budget in Wisconsin has dropped dramatically since the year 2000. And in fact, in 2011, Governor Scott Walker proposed dissolving the agency in total and putting it into the Department of Tourism. And the state of Kansas actually got rid of their arts board, but they eventually bring it back. So I don't know if we're going to see a complete, it's too early in the game to see how it's going to shake out. But what I think you won't see the little sort of programs that got support, such as there were some great projects, money for an art summer camp at Shell Lake. They had residencies at Oneida Nations Reservation near Green Bay. There were preservation projects at the Heritage Center in Superior. And so you're going to see the smaller projects, I think, getting less support. But I think a place like Madison will, so we have more of the same, but fewer interesting ideas.
Now, this is a proposal. This is a budget model that it sounds like the Trump administration is going to look at. Are we seeing pushback already to the idea of cutting the NEA and the NEH?
Oh, yeah, there's because the NEH and NEA are federal agencies, they cannot lobby on their behalf. And so there are several organizations that are lobbying on their behalf, including Penn, the American Alliance of Museums, Americans for the Arts, and the Federation of State Humanity Councils. And so they've been doing legislative efforts. And here in Wisconsin, Wisconsin Arts had a a legislative day yesterday, pushing for bills that could support arts and the role that it plays, not just in our culture, but in our economy.
We'll leave it there for now. Liz, thanks a lot for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Liz DiNovella, cultural critic and digital reporter based in Madison. She was with us to talk about the potential elimination of the National Endowments for the Arts and Humanities, the effect those changes could have here in Wisconsin.
I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferret. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network.